Well, as I mentioned earlier, this evening is our final in the series, for the time being at least, of looking at the life of David. We've been tracing him since 1 Samuel chapter 16, when, if you remember, we had the famous story of David killing Goliath and him being anointed as king by Samuel. But at that time, of course, it was a secret anointing as king, because there was already a king, Saul. But Saul, of course, had been rejected by God because of his unfaithfulness. So what's now going to become of David? That was maybe the question that we were asking right at the beginning of our story. It's hard sometimes, isn't it, to forget what we already know. But no doubt the first readers of that story, that's the question that they would have been asking. Maybe the first time you heard the story, that was the question that you were asking. What's going to become of David? And as the story goes on, we find that the separation between David and Saul gets more and more marked. And although David, in some ways, is a great hero of the people, although in many ways he's Saul's right-hand man, Saul, very consciously, very deliberately, over a long period of time, drives him away. Many times, Saul tries to kill David, doesn't he? Saul doesn't want David to be king. And many times he asks for forgiveness. Many times he tells David, I'm going to stop trying to kill you, and I'm going to stop this now. But each time he returns back to his old tricks. So how does David manage for so long? Well, as we've been going through this series, we've seen two things that have been true about David, haven't we? And to answer that question, how did he escape from the wrath of Saul? And two things happened. Firstly, we have to say that David at times was very cunning and canny, wasn't he, in the things that he tried to do. He gathered together a group of men around him who might have been able to protect and help him, perhaps. At times, he slipped over the border into Philistia, where it seemed as though Saul would not be able to get him. But was that the reason that David managed to escape from Saul all of that time? Well, actually, as we've been reading 1 Samuel, we find almost the opposite is true, isn't it? That as David has done those things for himself, as it were, particularly as he slipped over the border into Philistia, things very often, instead of getting better, ended up getting worse. When David used his own wisdom and his nous to be able to try and maneuver and protect himself from Saul, he ended up sometimes out of the frying pan into the fire, didn't he? So much so that it wasn't that long ago, just a couple of chapters back at the end of 1 Samuel, that he found himself lining up with the Philistines about to attack his own people. Now, David didn't survive because he was canny or clever. Actually, what we find in those chapters in 1 Samuel is that David survived because the Lord had plans for him. Because the Lord had anointed him to be king. And therefore, until David was officially king, as it were, then he was immortal. There was no way that Saul was going to be able to kill him, because God was the one who made sure of that. So as David was there on the mountain, and Saul and his army were chasing him, and David was going one way round the mountain, and then Saul's armies were coming round the other way, and then David would go this way, and Saul's armies were coming round the other way, and then Saul's armies split, and they're bound to get David. He's going to get squished in the middle of the pincers. And it's just at that moment that the Philistines attack, and Saul's army has to be called off to go and deal with the Philistines, and David runs free. Coincidence? Cleverness on David's part? No, that's the protection of God. How else could it be that in the very place where David and his followers go to hide from Saul, they go into a cave in the mountain, and it's at that very place where King Saul goes into the cave to relieve himself, utterly alone and unarmed. How could that be? Cleverness on David's part? Not at all. That's the sovereign protection of God. And that's what David has experienced all this time. And it's important to note, isn't it, that David hasn't been perfect in all this time. It's not that he's got everything right. In fact, David is fallible often. And in some ways, David's mistakes are clearer on the page than the mistakes of many characters in the Bible. But despite that, despite his imperfections, despite his failings, despite the fact he doesn't always get things right, always There's this sovereign protection from God. That's been the big theme really running through Samuel. Now we get to that stage in the story when it seems as though everything was really hotting up, wasn't they? Things almost couldn't get any worse. A couple of weeks ago, we were looking, as I've said, as David was lined up all ready to attack Israel's army. What on earth was he going to do? And even when God in his providence got him out of that situation, David then goes back to his city to find his own city's been burned down and his family and the family of all his soldiers have been carted off into captivity. And God in his grace and mercy gets David out of that situation as well, as David looks to the Lord and prays to him for guidance and help, and God answers David's prayers. And then 1 Samuel ended with chapter 31, a chapter that we haven't read. Because we've been focusing on the life of David, we didn't read chapter 31, which was all about Saul. But that's where we read what happened to Saul as David was dealing with the Amalekites. So here's David, he's dealing with the Amalekites, and there's this great battle between Israel and the Philistines raging to the north. And we read about that in chapter 31. And you can almost think of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel as kind of series 1 and series 2 of a great dramatic production on the television. You know, there's always a kind of cliffhanger, isn't there? Particularly at the end of a series. It's quite common nowadays, isn't it? So you've got to wait for all summer or maybe even a year or two before you find out what happened next. Those of you who are into Sherlock might remember that. And you think, well, what happened? There was this death, it would seem, at the end of, was it series two? And what's going to happen next? Well, here at the end of series one, as it were, of 1 Samuel, we have the death of Saul. But there's no happy ending, there's no resurrection. Death in reality is final, isn't it? Even if it's not always on television. And this great battle rages, and Saul, chapter 31, verse 3, is severely wounded by the archers. So Saul, he doesn't want to be captured. Can you see that in verse 4? Lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me. You can imagine as the king, he might be carted off and held up and tortured, as it were, and mocked and humiliated and ridiculed. He doesn't want that. So he asks his armor bearer to kill him. And Saul takes the sword from the armor bearer because the armor bearer won't do it. Verse 4, and he falls on his own sword. He commits suicide rather than be taken by the Philistines. The armor bearer then, he falls on his sword. And Jonathan, it seems from verse 6, is already dead. So what a tragic end to the story of Saul. He was the one chasing David around the country, wasn't he? He was the one trying to kill David, throwing spears at him and so on. And now Saul himself has been cut through by arrows that have come from a distance and now fallen on his own sword. What a tragic end to Saul. But we have to say we're not surprised, are we, as we've read through the story? Because here is one who has opposed God in almost everything that he's done in the section of Samuel that we've read. He's tried to fight against God's will. He knows that it's God's will that David be king, and Saul has tried to fight against it. And he literally is fighting a losing battle, isn't he? And here in chapter 31, we see the final end of Saul in his final battle that he's lost. And I think it is worth pointing out at this moment that there's a temptation probably that all of us have, isn't there, at times, to fight against God. Do you know what that is like? You know God's will deep down for you. Maybe not in every detail, but the big things. You know what God's will is for your life. You know what God would have you do. And there are certain times when you're reading the Bible, and it's not a matter of guidance necessarily, it's a matter of obedience and holiness. And you know what God would have you do, but you don't want to do it. And maybe you value your own position. Maybe you value your own autonomy. Maybe you feel there's no pleasure in what God wants. You feel wrongly about that, as we heard this morning. But for whatever reason, you just don't want to do what God has in store for you. And I think all of us probably know, don't we, what it's like to fight against God and to try and push God away. Well, we need to be very careful about doing that, don't we, to say the least. Because this was a tragic end for Saul. It was an inevitable end for Saul. He could have stepped down and abdicated and handed over the throne peacefully to David. He could have done that. He could have accepted David's rightful claim to the throne. He could have done that. But he fought to oppose God to his face. And this is his end. And if you and I oppose our God to his face, as it were, if we refuse to submit to his sovereignty, that he really is king over our lives, then our fate will be no better than Saul's fate, will it? Because the one who takes God on is never the victor, but is always fighting a losing battle. So Saul, in that sense, is very much a warning to us, isn't it, as we approach the scriptures. Now, as we continue then, our focus obviously is not Saul, but David. And as we come to chapter 2 and verse 1, which is where we began our reading, at that point, those people who've been reading through 1 Samuel know all about the death of Saul, but David doesn't know. Because remember, he's been chasing the Amalekites, haven't he? He's been trying to win back his wives and all of his belongings and those of those around him. And he's been chasing after the Amalekites. He's had his own battles. He hasn't had time even to hear about what's going on with Saul. So David now has returned back to Ziklag, and it's 3 days after the death of Saul. You see, the battle is so far distant that it takes that length of time for news to come down and to reach David where he is. And on the third day then, this man comes from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. In other words, he's a man who's in mourning. That's the point. He's wanting to make sure that David knows and that the other Israelites that he meets knows. He's not happy that the king of Israel is dead. And as he's traveling through Israelite country through most of the time, although he's obviously had to go over into Philistia to meet with David, but most of the time he's traveling through Israelite country, and he wants everyone to make sure that they know that he's sad, he's in mourning for the king of Israel. I don't know if you've had the experience of going to a feisty football match, but I can assure you that it's been a long time now, but the times when I used to follow Wrexham, and sometimes we'd come down to the Vetch and a famous victory from Wrexham, we made pretty careful afterwards that we wouldn't look too happy walking back to our car afterwards. We tried to look depressed like all the Swansea fans were looking around us. We didn't want to seem too happy, you see, and this is what this Amalekite is doing here. He wants people to know, as he's with the Israelites, he wants them to know that he's mourning the king of Israel. But he's trying to play his cards very carefully, because he's come to David quite deliberately. It's not a coincidence that he's arrived with David, because this Amalekite presumably has heard that it's David who's going to be the one who's going to be the next king of Israel. And what this Amalekite is doing is he's making sure that he gets to the next king of Israel, because he's got some things that will be wanted by him. He's got the arm band of King Saul, you see, and he's got this news that he wants to bring. So here is the Amalekite. He comes before David. He's singled him out. David's reputation has gone before him. David's asked him where he's come from Israel, from the camp. And of course, verse 4, what David's concerned about is what happened. This is his first chance for news. And David is concerned about what's going on elsewhere. And very quickly and briefly, there's a lesson there for us too, isn't there? That we too ought to be concerned about what the Lord is doing for our brothers and sisters. Just as David was concerned here. We should be looking for news, eager to hear what the Lord is doing. And David asks him then, please tell me. And he gets this description about the great defeat, and many of the people are fallen, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also. And David, again, this is a good example to follow. He wants clarification, does he? He wants to be sure. What's the evidence? How do you know? He doesn't want to go for after a rumor or so on. So he asks for evidence. And how do you know it? And this Amalekite comes up with this story. I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa. It's not a very good story if he's trying to make things up. It doesn't sound very persuasive, but there it is. That's the story he comes up with. There was Saul leaning on his spear. The chariots and the horsemen followed after him. And I looked and he asked me to kill him, verse 9. For anguish has come before him. So maybe this Amalekite saw what was going on with the armor bearer and Saul and so on. Maybe he was involved in the battle nearby somehow, and he saw what was going on. And what the Amalekite is doing here is he's pretending to David that he was what the sword bearer was asked to do. Do you see? That he was the one who finished off Saul. And he's trying to be very clever here, I think, the Amalekite. Because on the one hand, he's come in as one who's in mourning for the king. He's come in telling David, look, I only did it because he asked me to do it. I was following orders of the king. I wouldn't have just killed him in a battle. No, that wouldn't have been me. But I did exactly what I asked him. He asked me to do. But I'm sure this is part of what he's trying to get across. I was the one who finished off your enemy. I was the one that finally did it. And that's why he's made this trek down from the mountain down to Ziklag. Because he thinks there's going to be favor from David now. Because he's the one who was instrumental, as he tells the story, of making sure that David could now ascend to the throne. Of course, the Amalekite story isn't true, is it? We know that because of chapter 31. It's not what happened at all. Saul fell on his own sword. This Amalekite had nothing to do with it. But he's trying to, it would seem, to gain credit with David. And he's playing his cards very carefully, not being too happy with the fact that Saul is dead, but at the same time making David aware that if it wasn't for him. And that's what this man does. So how does David respond? Well, he sees verse 10, the crown and the bracelet, Saul's crown and Saul's bracelet, and the Amalekite now has brought them to David. And if there was any doubt in David's mind before, there's no doubt now. There's no way that Saul would allow his crown and his bracelet to be torn from his arm while he was still alive. Surely Saul is dead, as has been said. Surely Israel has been defeated, as the Amalekite has said. And whether David believes everything the Amalekite says, I don't know. But it was clear, wasn't it, that a great tragedy had occurred, that there was a great defeat in battle. And that Saul was dead, and much Israel too. So how does David respond? Well, it's very clear, isn't it? Verse 11. David took hold of his own clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. You see, as soon as David heard this terrible news about what had happened to Saul and to Jonathan and to all Israel, he mourned, verse 12, and wept and fasted until evening. You see, there's still this question of what we do with this Amalekite and all that's happened, but all that's put on hold, all that seems to wait. Because all that matters to David in this moment is that he needs to express his grief in mourning. And those of you who have lost dear loved ones, as David had, we're told, aren't we, at the end of chapter 1, that the love of Jonathan was wonderful, and greater even than the love of women, such as Jonathan's faithfulness and sacrificial love and care for David. Such was their attachment. And now Jonathan is gone. And Saul, the king of Israel, that great symbol of the people, he's gone too. And for David, the only appropriate response is one of mourning. And those, as I said, who have lost loved ones, you can understand that and empathize with that, can't you? That overwhelming sense of anguish and mourning that can come. And everything gets put on hold while this process goes on. Everything gets put on hold. And their mourning, we're told very clearly, aren't we, verse 12, it's not just for Jonathan, it's for Saul and for Jonathan, for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel. David's concern not only about his best friend, not only about his king, but he's concerned for the ordinary people, his brethren in that wider sense, his his fellow countrymen. He's concerned about them. He's mourning for them. We're coming into a period, aren't we, very much when we're thinking back at the First World War. It seems such a long time ago, 100 years ago, very nearly to the time of the start of the First World War. Many of you can remember the Second World War, of course, and some of you can even remember anew some of those who fell. And there was this great national mourning, wasn't there, during the First World War, the Second World War, and of course afterwards. And we still continue that to a certain extent. It's right to remember these things. But here in 2 Samuel 1, this is not something that is done reflecting back of something in the distant past. There's an immediacy here, isn't there? There's an anguish and a grief, a mourning, a weeping, a fasting. And as I said, everything gets put on hold. And we shouldn't be embarrassed or ashamed about grief at all. Grief is a natural thing for the Christian to experience when loved ones die. Because death itself is unnatural and a terrible thing, isn't it? And the Bible's very clear about that. Entered into the world through sin. And therefore, when it happens, we feel bereft, we feel lost, we feel as David felt. And it's right that we give expression to that as David did. But the mourning, verse 12, continues. But then there's this young man who needs to be dealt with. And he's the one who's confessed to killing the king of Israel, isn't he? Do you remember David's great solidity? There was no way that he was going to kill the king of Israel, was there? I dare not kill the Lord's anointed. He had the opportunity, you might even say he had the motive, except he didn't, to kill Saul, but he refused at every moment. And now here's this Amalekite who admits to killing the king. He was lying. I'm not sure if David knew that or not, but that was his testimony. I've killed the king of Israel. And David now is the heir apparent. He's the one who administers justice in the land. So what's he going to do with this man? Well, he asks in this question, this fearful question, verse 14, how was it you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? How dare you? How dare you do this? You see, it wasn't so much that Saul was precious to him, although that was certainly true. But what concerned David all the way through this story, that Saul was the Lord's anointed. And that in attacking Saul, that he was really attacking the Lord. He was taking into his own hands something that the Lord himself was going to work out. He was trying to speed up providence, as it were, in this way. And David would have no truck with that. And again, there is a clear lesson for us here, isn't we? All of us are tempted at times to try and speed up providence, to take things into our own hands. And the danger is that when we do that, we can end up doing the thing that really only God can do. And that's what the Amalekite did here. In a sense, there wasn't a problem with Saul losing his life and being taken from the throne in that way. In a sense, there was no problem with that, but that was for God to do in God's timing and in God's way. It wasn't for the Amalekite to claim to have done so himself. It wasn't for David to do so himself, as David well knew. And we need to be very careful not to take things into our own hands that really only the Lord can do. So David therefore administers the punishment as one who brings justice must do. And he executes this man for killing the Lord's anointed, verse 16. As we're reading those verses and we read here about this death of the Lord's anointed, this destroying of the Lord's anointed, it's hard not to think, isn't it, of the true anointed one of the Lord. When I talk about that, I'm talking, of course, of Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, because Christ in Greek and Messiah in Hebrew means the anointed one. And the Lord Jesus really was the king over all Israel. He wasn't a despotic king or even a mad king, as Saul was at times. He wasn't a king who would go against God's rule, as Saul did at times. But he was the king who, in all his goodness and mercy and love, really did rule over God's people. He is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, as we all know. And yet, in some ways, just like Saul, he was struck down. His death was in a battle. His death, as it were, was something that he was quite aware of, that he knew it was coming, just as Saul knew that his death was coming. But of course, there the similarities end, don't they? Because as Saul was killed in this battle, he was defeated by the enemy. Whereas when Jesus Christ was killed at the cross, the enemy thought that they were defeating him. And the Romans and the Jews who plotted against Jesus thought that they were defeating Jesus. I'm sure even Satan himself thought that he was defeating Jesus. But actually, Jesus Christ is not like King Saul. The Lord Jesus Christ is the true King, the leader of Israel. And he conquered death, as Saul, of course, could never do. And through his death, it would be that you and I might be saved. But still that question. Can we ask that question of the Pharisees? Can we ask that question of the high priests? Can we ask that question of the Roman soldiers? Can we ask that question of those who were onlookers? Can we ask that question? How dare you put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? That's the question, isn't it? That's the question. How dare you put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And yet, how does Jesus Christ answer that question, as it were, as he's dying on the cross, as nails are through his hands and his feet, as a crown of thorns is in his hand, as he's being mocked and ridiculed? How does Jesus answer that question? Do you remember his words? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Whereas our heart and our attitude might well be as David's here. How dare you do this? The heart of the Son of God is, Father, forgive them. And we see something, don't we then, of the heart of Jesus Christ. At that moment, of that great, terrible moment, as he's dying there on the cross, his mind is turned to forgiveness. And we don't have to go far, do we, into the book of Acts after the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And we read in Acts chapter 2 and verse 36, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ, both Lord and Anointed One. And as Peter is speaking there to the crowd, yes, they're in Jerusalem, but they've come to Jerusalem for the feast. They may well not have been there 40 days earlier when Jesus was crucified at Passover. This is a different feast. Many of them would not have been present. And yet Peter is able to say to them, this Jesus whom you crucified. And if Peter was able to say that to the crowd, therefore in Pentecost, does he not say that to us today too? This Jesus whom you crucified. This Jesus whom I crucified. And surely we've therefore got to ask ourselves the question, if it could be asked of the Amalekites, if it could be asked of him, how much more can it be asked of us? How was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Well, how did we do it? How was it that we killed the King of Israel? Well, Peter makes clear, isn't it? It was we who crucified him. Why? Well, because it was our sin that led to that. The sin of every man and woman and boy and girl. It's sin that put Jesus Christ on the cross. The sin of the world that put Christ on the cross. Are you excluded from that? Am I excluded from that? You see, the Christian begins to realize and to know and even to believe and trust that it was for my sin that Jesus died. It was my sin that held him there, as it were. How dare you put forth your hand against the Lord's anointed? And yet even when we ask ourselves this question, we hear gloriously, joyfully, don't we? The voice of Jesus calling down from the cross. as the accusations fly, and Satan knows how to accuse, doesn't he? That's his name, after all. He is the accuser. He knows how to accuse. How dare you do it? How dare you do it? And yet over that tumult, over those accusing words, we hear this loud, clear voice. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And those are the words of Jesus to men and women and boys and girls who trust in him. And we know the forgiveness of Jesus Christ, don't we, if our trust really is in him. We know what it is to have our sins forgiven and to have peace with God. And despite us deserving what the Amalekites suffered, we find that mysteriously, wonderfully, majestically, gloriously, Christ suffered in our place. And because he died, we go free. How was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? I don't know how it was I was not afraid. I don't know how it was that I was bold enough to sin despite the fact I knew God was watching. I don't know how it is that I felt able to push God away for years and years and years. I don't know. But I thank God that Jesus Christ prayed, Father, forgive, for they know not what they do. So we move then into the second half of the 2 Samuel 1. And briefly we have this long lament now from David. You see, there's a sense in which the urgency of his grief in chapter 12, this mourning and weeping and fasting until evening, that can't carry on forever, can it? It can't carry on forever, especially not at this moment with so much pressing. But that doesn't mean that the grief will stop. It doesn't mean that the mourning will stop. It doesn't mean that the lamentation will stop. Because what we find in verse 17 is that after the immediacy of this great grief that is poured out in verse 12, there's this, what we might think of ongoing remembrance of the sadness and the grief of what's come to mind. Because what we find here is that in a much more thoughtful way, a way that's expressed in words rather than in a pouring out of emotion, we read that David creates this lament. We shouldn't be surprised by it. We know about David's Psalms, don't we? About his ability with words and with music. This, therefore, is how he responds to this grief. But notice verse 18, it's important. He told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow, as it's written in the book of Jasher. And there comes the song. You see, this wasn't a way of just getting it out of his system so that he could forget about it and move on. It's not what's going on here, is it? David wants this to be remembered. It's important that Saul and Jonathan and those others who lost their lives are not forgotten. It's important that they're remembered. It's important that they're lamented. And that's what David puts into writing. And that's important for us too, that we don't forget those who have gone before, that they are remembered, that they are honoured. And Saul was honoured here, wasn't he? Perhaps even more than he deserved, you might say, thinking about verse 23 in particular. And David honours Saul and Jonathan in what he says, and he pours out his heart in this lament with this recurring theme, how the mighty have fallen. And you see what David is doing there as he writes this psalm, as he writes this lament. What he's doing is not only honouring the name of Saul and Jonathan and remembering them, but he's also crucially learning lessons from them, isn't he? And therefore teaching lessons to others. And it's vital that as Christians, that's how we respond. We respond by teaching ourselves and teaching others through what we do. And here, that's what David is doing. How the mighty have fallen. And it will do David good to remember that, won't it? It will do you good to remember it, and me too. How the mighty have fallen. It occurs there right at the beginning in verse 19. It occurs at the end in verse 27. It occurs as well in a slightly different form in verses 21 and 22. How the mighty have fallen. And as we reflect back on our own pasts, it's vital that we learn lessons from those pasts that will help us And here the lesson that David has taken is the mighty can fall. And as he is about to take up the kingship of Israel, or Judah first of all, and then Israel, so he needs to remember that just because he's the king, it doesn't put him in a place where he can't be touched. And he's as vulnerable as Saul was. How the mighty has fallen. Sadly, there will be a time in the future when David will forget the lesson that he teaches himself here. But nonetheless, at this point, it's a wise thing to do to try and remember and learn lessons from the past. And as we maybe reflect on loved ones, or we reflect on our brothers and sisters in Christ that are now in glory, we can do the same, not just to honour their name, not just to lament their passing, but to learn lessons from their lives. How the mighty have fallen was the lesson that David learned here. And having done all that, he then, chapter 2, he's now finally appointed king of Judah. There's still a long way to go before he's going to be king over the whole of the nation. At this point, it's just Judah, the one tribe down in the south. There's trouble ahead. We'll deal with that at a much later time. But at least finally, there's one tribe that's willing to commit him as their king. And as David, therefore, comes to the end of this period in his life, we're able to look back, aren't we, and look back and see lessons from David's life as well. Just as David looked back at Saul's life and found lessons there, we now can look at David's life and see lessons for him as we close this series. And what is it that we need to learn? Well, more than anything else, surely again, it's the providence of God, isn't it, in keeping David. Surely it's the providence of God who in mysterious ways, wonderful ways, sometimes very difficult ways, kept David because he had this work for him to do. And there was no way that David was not going to be able to fulfill what it is that God had called him to. And so it is for us today, isn't it? We don't have to be fearful of all the events that are going around about us. There may be many things that seem out of control, many things that we don't understand, many things that we can't control. But we must never forget that God is in control. He's in control of your life and of mine. He's in control of our neighbours and friends and even our enemies if we have them. God is in control. And he will not let us go. He will not let us down. And whatever happens, he will keep us. He will protect us. He will guide us. And all things really will work together for the good of those who love God.